You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is The Sound of Photography, and I'm Frank Watson. The show deals with all things photographic, and my guest this week is Vincent McAvoy. Vincent was for many years an art director in both advertising companies, including Ogilvy and Mather, and record companies, including Polydor. We're going to talk about how photography is a key component in both industries, and his experiences of working with both photographic imagery and photographers. He will also talk about his friendship with Andy Warhol and his present project, The Little House of Rock, where he produces silk-screened images of pop and rock icons. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Frank, thanks for having me.
We're going to do a little bit of biographical work here. So you started your career in Liverpool, where you went to Liverpool Art College.
That's right.
And you studied graphic design. And in a way, this was the late 60s. That was a great time to be in Liverpool, I think. You know, you were at the centre of the world in terms of Beatlemania and whatever else you want to define it as.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was sort of post-Merseybeat almost. Mm-hmm. There was a lot going on in Liverpool. It was a booming city then. Mm-hmm. And John Moores, who was the owner of Littlewoods, where I was working, mm-hmm. was sponsoring the painting competition. John Moores and Hockney had won it. I think Peter Blake also won it the following year. So there was a lot of activity.
And so art excitement. And music, and we should say poetry with the Liverpool poets as
well. Of course. Yeah.
So after you left college, you walked quite easily into a job because jobs were easily available in design then. And you started as a junior designer with Littlewood's fashion catalogue, is that right?
That's right. It was a huge studio and very exciting. There was a lot going on there, these massive catalogues. And I first came across the really great work of people like Cornell Lucas and F. John French, who were the
pivotal fashion photographers of the time. Yeah,
that was being used. Mm. All of the work was done on 10x8 transparencies, then huge things. And that's the first time I saw things being briefed on just style and feel, really, and shot as people wanted them, photographers wanted them to be.
Right. And as a junior, in the company, what were your responsibilities?
Well, I was learning everything, the typography, paste-up work, putting together the layouts. Mm. And I was also delivering the layouts into studios in London, like King's Road, and that was great.
So you were travelling down from Liverpool to London?
Yeah.
Right, so you were the messenger as well.
Yeah, I was doing everything, really. Yeah. It was a great learning process, and we were retouching everything by hand then, and slicing things together, cutting transparencies.
Yeah, sort of cut and paste with scalpels and so forth. Yeah.
We used a lot of chemicals, and we'd spray the transparencies if they're wrong colour. Ethyl acetate and benzene.
Right. Had you learned those skills at college, or were you taught them on the job?
I was taught them at Littlewoods, really, to be honest, because you had to do them. It was for reproduction. Yeah. So,
and what did you take to that easily, or was it quite a long time before you were trusted to work on originals?
I learned slowly. You know, like a junior would. Yeah. You know,
But good skills to learn, and would sort of carry. Those skills would carry on.
Yes,
through advertising.
Yeah, retouching is still used today, isn't it? It's Photoshop, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But this was pre-Photoshop. So,
You
know, the digital wasn't going to happen for for another 20 years. Really.
That's right.
Yeah. So, you talked a little bit about John French and Cornell Lucas, the fashion photographer. Did you meet them, or were you just working with their images?
Well, I was seeing the prints coming in and working with their colour transparencies, and I used to go to Flood Street to drop off layouts for Cornell Lucas, who I was amazed. He looked like Rex Harrison just sitting there, you know, with his tweed jacket and real character, really. So just a fleeting moment, really.
And tell us a bit more about, you know, the design studio. Was that predominantly men working in the design studio at that
time? I'd say, yeah, there was one girl out of about 20, 25 guys.
Yeah, so it was a very male environment.
Yeah.
And was it very competitive, or was it just you know, were people very supportive of you? As
they were at the time. Yeah, they were really great and really treated me well as a junior and had time to show me the ropes and all the things to do. Yeah.
So it was, quite a sort of caring environment in terms of that you were there to learn and they were happy to teach you.
That's right.
Well, that's good. And so how long were you there for?
Well, I spent nearly 4 years there. I've moved up to be a sort of layout visualizer in the end, which was a bit like being an art director. And I was looking at all the great work that was coming from London, the magazines and Nova, Harper's and Queen. So I was always thinking, eventually I need to be in London, you know, it's only so long.
But you were sort of soaking up, the image environment at that time, you know, in the sort of 60s was radically changing and becoming less, less conservative. I'm probably most aware of sort of album covers, and we're going to come on to that. But, you know, the fashion world of people like David Bailey and Terence Donovan, you know, they were really shifting the sort
absolutely.
Of environment, weren't they? Were you aware of that sort of work?
Well, only through looking in magazines. I know that I think Bailey and maybe Donovan, someone could correct me on this, were both working for F. John French as assistants.
As assistants, that's right. So
it's a sort of a reciprocal thing. And all the great, the Bieber catalogue, Peter Knapp's work on French magazines, it was very different, you know, very exciting.
So you were looking at European magazines as well as English ones, And were they ahead of the British scene, or would you say they were behind us at that point?
They were probably equal, I'd say, the French magazines.
Okay. We're going to play some music. This is a little bit of nostalgia for you, Vincent. See what you think. I'm not even going to say what it is, but most people will be familiar with it.
Life goes on day after day. Hearts torn in every way. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay. People, they rush everywhere. Each with their own secret care. So ferry across the Mersey, and always take me there, the place I love. People around every corner, they seem to smile and say, we don't care what your name is, boy, we'll never turn you away. So I'll continue to say, here I always will stay. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay, and here I'll stay, here I'll stay.
You're listening to The Sound of Photography. My guest this week is Vincent McAvoy, and we're talking about advertising and the music industry in the 60s and 70s. So we've talked about your time in Liverpool, Vincent, and learning on the job. And at some point, I guess, you became frustrated with what you'd learned. You know, you weren't learning anymore, and perhaps London was calling. Is that right?
Sure, yeah. And I went to London. My first job was at Gears Cross Advertising, drawing up Home Pride flower graders for the writers there.
Yeah.
There were lots of jobs that you could get, and the strange thing was you didn't really know how good a place was till you actually took the job and started working there. Mm. But I didn't really want to be drawing up storyboards year in, year out.
I mean, I think picking up on that point, you were saying earlier that, you know, you could, jobs were easy to come by. You know, you could walk out of a job on a Friday and have a job on Monday. I mean, that just wouldn't happen now, would it? You know, there's too many, either there's too many qualified people or not enough businesses to sort of, you know, to cope with the demand of students coming through, really.
Yeah, I think there's two things. Everything was done by hand then, really. There was nothing digital. So everything, every bit of artwork or creative work had to be drawn up and illustrated. And, you know, that some of the places were great, some of the agencies, but there was no way of finding out who was doing the good work till perhaps reading through the trade magazines. But it was a hard thing to get information about quality work.
Right. So, you know, you could arrive and after the first week think this is, the job isn't for me. I'm going to get out at the first opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of agencies would have like a great account, like Lily White's, for instance, doing great fashion work. And, you know, 2 weeks later, they'd lost the account and that was their main, you know, shop window.
So the business could fold just quite quickly. Yeah. Yeah. So there was a sort of chance encounter that made your career sort of move sideways a bit, where you were invited by the band ELP, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, to produce some images for their world tour. Is that right?
That's right. It was
tell us about it.
A little weekend job. Somebody phoned me up and said, did I want to do some background work for this group, prog rock group? And it turns out that it was Emerson, Lake and Palmer. We had to illustrate their European tour, the first bit of music they'd play on that tour. And we drew up 20 or 30 original pieces of work over a weekend, myself and two illustrators, to help them put this background slides together. Mm. And that was quite an amazing experience. It was hard work, but it showed me that there was some great work to be done out there.
Yeah. And I think you had to go along and meet the band and get their sort of view on what you'd done over that weekend.
Yes, on a Monday I had to go to Shepperton Studios. I'd never really seen anything like that. Big studio and people working, trucks and things. It was quite amazing.
So it's a sound studio, or was it a film studio?
It's Shepperton Film Studios, but they were recording there and they had a lot of equipment and huge wattage amplifiers and what have you.
Right. So you showed them the work, and what was the reception?
They loved it. We worked really hard because I didn't know much about them, but when we saw the original album covers, we realised they knew about art and they had very high standards. So we had to sort of step up and produce some really good.
So did they have art college backgrounds, or were they, I mean, Keith Emerson was a bit of a sort of classical musician at one point, I think, wasn't he, before he was?
Yeah, I honestly didn't know that much about them.
It could have been anyone.
Found out the hard way.
Yeah, they were sort of, big in their time. So these artworks were projected behind the band as they played?
That's right. They had three 40-foot screens that came down and just projected these images, which illustrated the lyrics on the first number.
Right. So you were working to a set of lyrics, which, so that's the song came to life through the images that you produced.
That's right, yes.
Okay. And through that, something sort of happened, didn't it? You started to move away from advertising towards, well, you tell us the story.
Well, I realised that there was some great work to be done in other places than a small agency, and the job at Polydor was advertised in Campaign magazine. And when I had these slides, all this work in my portfolio, it really helped me improve my work. And they hired me from those slides, I'm pretty sure. You know.
Wow. So just that, having that in your portfolio, sort of lifted you into the area you needed to be, almost by accident.
That's right.
Yeah. So, so what you went to Polydor as what? As an art, as a fully fledged art director,
yeah,
or still a junior?
Oh gosh, no, they'd hired me as their art director then, and I was designing album covers and press ads for rock and pop and jazz and classical albums.
Right. So were there many art directors with Polydor, or were you the
Let's see, there were two other guys at the end, and then we had a third person come along. But we had a very good print production guy who helped us with any concepts before we'd present them to the artists, and he was great to help the thing roll along. It's quite a good, efficient machine.
Sure, sure. So that was a big department or a small department?
It was one part of Polydor's building in Stratford Place. The A&R people were upstairs, and they had a studio. People like Rory Gallagher and Neil Sedaka used to come in and play the piano there sometimes. We could hear them upstairs.
Right.
Great.
Oh, okay, good. And I think it was a fairly intense working environment, wasn't it? Or it became so?
When I added up, I think I did 300 album sleeves in about 3 years there, but not all were original. Some had to be adapted from American artwork, but we had sort of significant bigger ones that needed to be worked on, and bigger artists, obviously.
Right. I think one of them you mentioned was The Who's Quadrophenia. You had some input on that, which, you know, that was a fairly iconic album and still is, really.
Yeah, I mean, that was almost the first week I got there. We were waiting for this 36-page booklet, which Ethan Russell had been working on for months with them, and they'd been doing the music, obviously, and people have been talking about it a lot. And I remember seeing the huge stack of these beautiful prints, all hand-retouched again in those days.
These would have been, because the album, as I remember, is a triple Gate album, isn't it? It was all in black and white.
All black and white.
With a picture of a sort of mod on a scooter
That's
on the front
right.
cover.
Yeah.
I can't remember the other pictures. My memory's not there.
Well, it's the story of Jimmy. He'd illustrated it, shot it in Brighton. He'd done a huge amount of work on it.
Sort of like a visual story that reflected the songs.
Exactly.
Which was a concept album, wasn't it? After the second one after Tommy.
That's right.
Okay. So what was your input on that?
Well, I just had to manage the production of the pages, really. The photographs were all bleed on the side of the book, and reset the liner notes from Pete Townsend. I had to do all that overnight, which is always a shame to have to rush huge amount of typography, luckily just about fitted the next day.
Right. And did you have to sort of show the work to them, or how did that work? I mean, they're quite feisty characters, weren't they? Keith Moon, Pete Townsend.
Yes, they always had to approve the stuff. It's it was frustrating and exciting working with people like that. We had to send the artwork to the management, and then we'd wait to see if it was yay or nay. And luckily, it all went through. Approved, yeah.
But you didn't have to present the work to them in person?
No, we were
filtered.
Sort of kept apart.
And was that good, or was it frustrating?
Well, it's frustrating, really, because you're dealing with such big egos in the management department and everywhere else that when you get to meet people one-on-one, it's normally that they're absolutely fine with your ideas.
And you also worked on with Eric Clapton's album sleeves, is that right?
Yeah, I did a few with Eric Clapton. I did, there's one in every crowd, and after that, I can't remember.
461.
461 Ocean Boulevard, that's right. Yeah. That was his big comeback album, and I did all the promotional work for that, and that's when I started to win a lot of awards.
Right.
For the work that I'd done.
What specifically were the awards for? For the design or...?
On 461, it was for graphic design and in-store and posters, really, because the artwork was already for the album, came from the States, but it didn't have a very strong selling point.
Okay. And there was one, another album, what's it called? Another One in the Crowd? No, I've got that wrong.
It was called There's One in Every Crowd. Yeah. And we had been presenting a lot of ideas to him over the weeks.
This is Eric Clapton.
Yeah, sending them through his press people. And we were just getting back, no, don't like it. There was no discussion or let's have a meeting.
Yes or no, and it was always no.
It was always no. And eventually, I think it was on the very last day, because the album was pressed and the orders were in, title was known.
So you were really under pressure at this point, to desperately trying to please and come up with something.
Yeah, sure, because you knew that you'd be living with this thing forever, this cover, and people would see
it. And everyone's waiting for the release, and no one can get the cover right. And because Eric Clapton's not easy in terms of approval.
If we could have met him, it would have been a piece of cake.
So it's this idea of being filtered through different people.
Yeah.
But the irony is that he chooses a photograph, I think, from around... well, the 1920s, isn't it? It's a Jack Henri Lattigue picture of a dog.
That's right.
And it's not the most exciting picture, is it?
I know, and it didn't seem to tie in with the title, but I just got this message from him, use this.
Yeah.
So I put it on a bronze background. I thought, what can I do? And we had a picture of him on the back. But it was a real rush job at the time.
But you were also commissioning photographers, I think, weren't you, as well?
Yes, all the time. We had Hypnosis used to do some shots for us, and Graham Hughes. David Montgomery was really great when you had these big personalities.
Tell us a bit more about it, because Hypnosis did, I know them best for the Pink Floyd albums. Were you working alongside them, or you would go and meet them? Or how did a sort of concept come about when you wanted to use them? Were you feeding them, or were they telling you what they would do? Otherwise, they weren't going to do the job. How did that operate?
Yeah, they were a little bit, we could say, precious.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because they had, first dibs with Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, and they did have a great reputation, and their work was... very good quality. But occasionally we'd have a group like Focus or Cyril Haverman, a sort of rock group, and we'd think, that you could work with these guys and they could produce some nice images. And portraits.
So was it a case of just handing over to Hypnosis and they would give you something back? And
it was,
And you, I guess, for what they cost, you took it, and you rather than saying, no, we don't like that. I mean, I'm interested in that sort of negotiation, whether they're too big to fail. Was that the case, or was it you still said, well, no, I don't think you've quite got that right?
Well, no, you'd always try and, with anybody, get your idea across to them, and then any photographer try and hope, well, you'd hope it's like a collaboration that, you're both on the same page and you get a good result.
Yeah.
Which is normally the case.
You're working step by step, and you keep agreeing that the outcome is going to work. So it doesn't. You're not suddenly just given something where you think, uh-oh.
Right. No, it was always well planned out. It had to be. Yeah.
And David Montgomery, I mean, he's a sort of one of the big music photographers. So how would a commission work with him?
Well, David again very good with big personality. He could handle. He knew his photography, obviously, and
he was respected by the musicians, I guess, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's a good start.
He would get the shots.
Yeah.
But I always think of him, his pictures, from what I know of them, as being shots where he's photographing them performing live rather than the studio work. I wouldn't know his studio work, but...
Oh, no, he's very good in the studio. He's fantastic. And he had a great studio in town, great vibe in there, yeah. Mm.
So you would go along and...
Yes,
I mean, what sort of musicians were you working?
Well, David did a couple of pictures of the Hollies for me, which were, I won't say, it's difficult getting five guys, in a studio and getting them all looking as good as possible. Yeah. You need someone who can handle that sort of situation. Yeah.
Was he older than, would he have been older than the musicians or at that
only
point?
Only a little bit, but I think they all knew his work, from... Yeah. Jimi Hendrix or The Who, so you picked the people that would fit with the artists you wanted to work with.
And would there have been a stylist or anything like that? Or
in those days, not really. It wasn't like a fashion shoot. You'd obviously have a some decisions to make on the day if you didn't like someone's jacket or move them around a bit. But no, it's very much...
it's what they turned up with, and that's what you went along with.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's handling people with kid gloves as well. Yeah.
Well, they were pretty young as well, weren't they? Probably early 20s or something.
The Hollies. Yeah. Well, they'd been around a long time. Oh,
yeah, they were quite elderly, but okay, got that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the jazz work you did. I mean, that's quite interesting because a lot of the jazz musicians, I mean, we're talking about Sonny Stitt, Count Basie, Jimmy Smith, George Benson. That was more, those musicians were established by then, weren't they? So,
yes, that's right. And I guess a lot of those album sleeves would have been repackaging them. And it was always kind of a relief for a graphic designer to think there's nobody, no managers to negotiate with, there's no artist to present to. It was like a free, freed up brief, really.
So you could just go ahead and whatever happened was going to be okay.
Yeah, and the main thing was finding original photographs for people that you had to hunt through the archives of, you know, David Redfern or Val Wilmer. And there was always some great pictures, but it was whether you could find them in time and do some magic with them, retouch them or whatever.
Yeah. And were the photographers all right about you, playing around with the image and retouching? Or didn't you even ask them?
We probably would have bought them from David Redfern or Val Wilmer, if the jazz Buddy Rich, I think I did. We always paid for the rights.
But once you'd bought the rights, you could sort of, you had free play with what you did with it, or you just did anyway and never asked?
Yeah, people didn't mind, and if they got paid, they just...
And they were probably happy to be on an album, have their pictures on an album cover. Right. So we're going to play a piece of music by Gil Evans, which is one of the album covers that you worked on. And this is Gil Evans playing with Miles Davis from Sketches of Spain. Thank you. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. This is The Sound of Photography. And my guest this week is Vincent McAvoy, and we're talking about his work, his career in advertising and the music business. I'd just like to remind listeners that there's a website, thesoundofphotography.com, if you want to listen to shows that have been done in the past. So we're in the 1980s now, Vincent, and you decided to make a move away from Polydor. Tell us a bit about why and what reason that came about.
Well, it's a funny thing, but we used to see the guys from McCann Erickson coming in, taking a brief to do some advertising TV. And I used to think, gosh, those guys are really cool, you know. and when eventually I got a job at Ogilvy & Mather back in advertising, it was an exciting time in the UK. A lot going on, a lot of, big budgets. And there was people like Ridley Scott, directors coming in to do work on TV commercials. And all the art directors were teamed up with copywriters in these big agencies. Mm. So that was great to work with a copywriter.
Right. A team. So let's just talk, for instance, if we take a campaign that you would get a company approaching the company, and what's the first part? Is it the sort of text or is it the imagery? I mean, at what point does the sort of copywriter come in on the project?
Well, it's kind of, you get the brief for the two of you, and in theory, it's the copy is done by the copywriter, the words and the art by the art director, but it doesn't really have to work like that. It's a collaboration sometimes. Whoever comes up with the idea that's right that you present down the line.
So it could work either way. It could be text for image or images before text.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the exciting thing about it.
Yeah. So would you sit around a table and sort of bash away until something came up? Was it a sort of, I don't know, like a little, I'm trying to think of the word, where you'd get together in the pub or in a round the sort of table just talking about, just bashing ideas together? How did that work?
You have to sit down, face each other and come up with all the ideas that you can as quick
so
as possible.
So it would go quite mad, I would imagine, people getting quite sort of silly and, was there someone who sort of refereed it, who just sort of kept it in line, or was it a free-for-all?
Well, you would have to present your initial concept to the creative director, and you might have two or three teams working on a big account, and you'd give him your outline work and outline headlines, and obviously whichever was most suitable would go into production.
Yeah, okay. And the copywriters are quite interesting characters because often they were people who went on to be famous novelists, people like Fay Weldon and Salman Rushdie, of all people. I mean, so tell us a bit about, did you work with them or did they just sort of drop the material off? Or?
Well, those two big names had left by the time I was there in the 80s, but Indra Sinha was one of the star writers that we had there. He's gone on to write books, and all of the writers either came from newspaper reporting or, they were poets or they had a book to write. Mm. There was no training copywriters, really. They sort of drifted in to advertising.
So people with imagination and a way of turning words. Because also the catchphrase or the sort of little slogan is the sort of killer point of the advert, isn't it? If someone could come up with something witty or something that just sticks in the mind. Can you think of some examples?
Oh, my gosh. when I was there, so many campaigns had been running for ages.
None come to mind at the moment.
None.
Maybe we'll come back to that. So you were an art director at that point, an established art director, having left Polydor, is that right? So you were recognised as someone who was trusted and came up with the goods, and even though you had worked and established yourself in music, the transition into advertising was relatively easy, or was it a big shift in terms of a sort of mindset?
Well, not really, because you're just creating things and following a brief, really. somebody wants to communicate something, and you have to try and think of the best way to get that message across, and hopefully work with some good people and get some good work and some awards, maybe, or you know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people you, one of the clients was Purcell. Tell us about that, because it's quite a strange little story, isn't it?
Well, there was a Purcell washing up liquid brief that came in to sell some washing up liquid, and we honestly couldn't think of a good way of presenting it, because it was tagged to some rubber gloves they'd had made by Vivian Westwood or somebody, and we really couldn't think of a proper way of presenting this in a poster. And I had the idea of using Naomi Campbell, who'd had a lot of trouble at that time with the press. She would be sort of the last person you'd ask to do the washing up.
Remind me, why was she, just because she was outspoken, or what was the issue?
She had been in trouble through, you know, throwing a phone at somebody or being rude to somebody. I think these people do get, it's difficult for them, because people are always waiting to say, oh, you know, she spilt some coffee on me. And there's a story, you know, and they're selling it. So I think it's a
sort of tabloid
quid pro quo, really, fame. Yeah. And she was absolutely fantastic. We Tony McGee shot that for me. He's a really good fashion photographer, and she liked the idea of putting on these rubber gloves and posing for this ad. She thought it was quite cheeky.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
And then we come on to quite a big project, which led to all sorts of things that you probably couldn't have foreseen, which was working on a Polaroid campaign, wasn't it? The sort of, was this by that time the rise of Polaroid, or was Polaroid pretty well established?
Well, I think Polaroid was a bit of it was a bit of a forgotten thing, but I had a feeling that eventually it would come quite good at some point. I mean, it wasn't the best account at Ogilvy's, wasn't the most prestigious or anything. But I sort of thought it's got a lot of potential, because I was taking pictures and I'd used Polaroid a lot. And we did two commercials with that, one with both of them with Howard Gard, actually, two TV commercials. And when we needed to do a press campaign for Christmas, I asked Andy Warhol to do an ad for me, or a poster.
Right. Just out of the blue, you just sort of thought, oh, I'll just be cheeky and approach him. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I'd already done a few stills with Christopher Makos, who is based in New York, and he's a great black and white photographer, and I knew that he was a good friend with Andy.
Right.
So I sort of tentatively asked him, do you think Andy would do a poster for me? You know, not thinking it would happen.
When you say poster, do you mean billboards? Or?
Yes, yeah. And Andy was great. He came back with a yes right away, and we started from there, really. We had a whole group of people for this Christmas campaign. Brian Ferry was meant to be a carol singer. Grace Jones would have some Christmas decorations in a crazy hat. And Wayne Sleep, I think, was meant to be a pantomime horse, or front or the back. So we had a lot of celebrities that all signed up for it when they heard that Warhol was involved.
Yeah, yeah. So this was a sort of Christmas campaign to get people to use Polaroid cameras at Christmas, and, you know, so it was quite humorous, and but a sort of party spirit.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
But it didn't quite happen, did it?
unfortunately, as often happens in agencies, you can be working on something for 18 months and you go to research and this and that, and it just got shelved on the last minute. Yeah. So it was sort of embarrassing phoning all these people up again.
I mean, especially as these were big figures in, you know, celebrity figures.
And
it would have really pushed Polaroid in terms of its, you know, its sort of presence, wouldn't it? It would have been, it couldn't have been but successful, really.
It would have been a great campaign, but you have to take that on the chin sometimes. It happened.
Okay. Well, we're going to play some music. We're going to actually play two pieces. I'm going to play a small piece of music by Can from the soundtrack of Alice in the Cities by Wim Wenders, simply because it features a Polaroid camera running through a lot of it. And then we're going to run straight into a track by Japan, and the track is called Gentleman Take Polaroids. You're listening to Sound of Photography, and my guest this week, as I've said, is Vincent McAvoy. We're talking about his encounters with Andy Warhol, and we've been talking about the Polaroid campaign, which nearly took off. But subsequent to that, you were to meet Andy Warhol in person. How did that come about?
Yes, that's right. It was a little bit embarrassing because we, you know, had to pull out of that. But Andy used to say to Chris Makos, "So how's Vincent and where's
Chris
my job?"
Chris Makos was the photographer who you'd worked with, who was also a friend of Andy Warhol.
That's
so
right.
That was the link.
Sorry
to interrupt. Just.
And, I mean, it often happens that you have to pull out with a photographer or an illustrator or whatever, and you always, it's like a given that you will come back with a another job very soon, you know. And I mean, that was the impression that we would work together at some point, but it wasn't to be. Soon, within 2 years, I think he'd passed away. But we produced a book. Christopher had loads and loads of black and whites of the time he'd spent with Andy, and I thought it was a great idea to make a book about his day-to-day workings rather than his artwork. And
was this the time of being in the factory, or was there?
I guess not. It would be like late 70s and 80s.
Had the factory sort of closed by then, or?
Well, I think there were three factories. Yeah. Is that right?
I think you might be right.
Two.
Yeah,
they didn't. And this was more about when he was really making a lot of commercial work. Portraits and traveling the world, really, and going everywhere. And in Germany, I think he did 80 portraits in a couple of months or something of famous people.
And often, just to go back to the Polaroid, he would use Polaroids he took. I mean, he was one of the first to use Polaroids on a sort of day-to-day basis in much the same way as we use digital phones. So again, Andy Warhol gets there first because he starts. He almost invented the selfie, didn't he, really? Or, you know, this idea of people perpetually taking pictures of everyday life.
Yeah.
I know where he did, Debbie Harry, and that became a silkscreen print. So
that's
he would
right.
take the Polaroid.
Sure.
And actually translate it into a silkscreen reproduction.
Yeah. Well, he used to use what's called a big shot Polaroid, which I think are meant for dentists originally. So it's like a fixed lens.
Right.
And I think he probably did those
Debbie Harry. How big would that image have been then? Not a sort of
small
square.
Size.
Right. It was. I thought you were inferring that it was a bigger image.
No, it was like a fixed lens, Polaroid. Big chunky
thing. Oh, I see, a close-up.
Very hard to find now. And then he would get those, he'd take tons of images, hundreds, and pick one, get that approved, and he would blow it up huge, you know, 20-30, get a black and white made, and that would be the basis of his portrait, really.
Right. So that would get transferred into a silkscreen process where he introduces, what, paint or ink? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I mean, he was doing canvases and paper prints then,
Were they multiples or were they one-offs?
Well, he always did. He did portraits for people and their families and their children. I suppose they'd be more or less one-offs, but he'd always do a few extra ones and try and sell them.
A real eye for business, isn't he? Making money. Yeah. So he would, when he came over, he would to England. He would, you would meet up.
Yeah, he was very. You know, very friendly, and you know, everybody seems to have their own version of Andy Warhol. But the one I remember is him being very funny and very generous, and he encouraged me to start making screen prints again.
So you'd done that at college,
I'd done that way back.
Yeah, but you'd sort of forgotten. And
yeah.
But what did you talk about with him? I mean, was he? You know, in a way, you always. When you see him interviewed, I think he had his sort of interview technique where he was deliberately sort of minimalist. But presumably, if you sat over a meal with him, he was a bit more expansive.
Well, only a little bit.
Oh, right. So were you driving the conversation a lot?
No, he was very funny and very, very witty. And, you know, we would talk about all sorts of things, about, you know, how many... his size of his building and how many people he had working for him. And he was always worried about paying everybody and the next job and what was going to happen next year in his work. So but was he was really always thinking ahead. You know, you could tell he was like
driven.
Driven. He used to have a sort of act that he put on for interviews, and that was all his persona, really, press persona. It wasn't sort of real him.
A little bit robotic, deliberately just to sort of deflect intimate questions, probably.
Yeah, that's right.
So was he a name dropper?
Not when I was around. I think he was. All he used to go out every single night, I think, to something or other, to an opening or a party. And
He was in London, you're talking?
Wherever he was. What would happen is his manager then, Fred Hughes, would call him in the morning, and or Andy would always have these long conversations on the phone, and he'd say, tell him about all the people he'd met the night before, who was the princess of so-and-so, and Fred would phone them up and say, do you want a portrait doing? So it was a great double act, really,
that he
would play the artist and then, you know, tell his manager who he'd met, and they would hopefully get some work out of it together.
Sure.
It was quite subtle.
Yeah. But he inspired you to...
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to him about how there were no older art directors around, and he said something like, just do what you want, Vincent, in the future. Just have you thought about doing some screen prints, which I'd started to do when the advertising work sort of dropped off. And it was great. You know, I really, really enjoyed it, and I started doing these.
So you've got your own studio now?
Yeah, I use a couple of studios, one in East London and one in West London, and I do all the artwork at home, and then I actually make the screen prints in the studio, and then I, you know, I sell them through Paul Smith or Liberty or Selfridges.
And give us an idea of the sort of things that you sort of screen print.
Well, I do a lot of graphics and ephemera, and I've started doing some portraits of my own photographs, which are back from the music business with Eric Clapton and David Bowie and Bob Marley. Mm. And I've done some
big... So you photographed them?
I did.
David Bowie?
The thing is, it's probably about getting the rights for photographs is difficult, so the easiest thing is to use the ones that you've got on hand.
And also you've got copyright over your own work rather than trying to buy up
someone else's
images.
If they're taken in a public place, you own the rights, which is great, you know.
So where could people see these?
Well, they're on my website, Little Shop of Rock, Instagram, Little Shop of Rock.
And how would someone like Paul Smith use your imagery?
Well, he asked me to make up the David Bowie image in four different colours for Paris Fashion Week last year. Right. He liked the original orange one I did and wanted three more to go with that.
So in the vein of Warhol a little bit, where you were tinting or toning? I know I haven't got the correct... phraseology for silk screen printing, you'd have to tell
it was
me.
Another version of the one chosen image.
And how would he use those images? As sort of backdrops? Or?
Well, he was selling them in his shops as editions.
Right.
So they were framed, they were up on them.
So a really good place to show your work.
Brilliant. Yeah. Great entrepreneur that he is.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you, Vincent, for telling us all the stories from 60s, 70s, 80s, and even today. And we're going to play out with David Bowie. And I want to thank John Dignam for engineering, and thank you for listening. And I think you can guess which track this might be.
It's Warhol, actually.
What did I say?
Hull. It's Hull. As in Hulls. What? Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol. Like Hull.
Andy Warhol, take one.
Cinemateque's biggest standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. But the people in my brain, two new pens to have a go, I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, have him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy walking, Andy tired, Andy take a little snooze. Tie him up when he fast asleep, send him on a pleasant cruise. When you wake up on the sea, be sure to think of me and you. To think about things and to think about blue, what a jolly boring thing to do. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Landrum, a machine. This whole society is a machine's concept of perfection. Peace, harmony,
but no soul.